The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
My title has been Redeeming the Urban Environment. I think we could be forgiven for feeling that the Bible has a prejudice against cities, despite the fact that God sent Noah to Nineveh, and Nineveh for a time repented. Nineveh was destroyed. Then that great, powerful city of Babylon was destroyed. It was the prototype of the rich and the arrogant city. And then the seemingly impregnable cities of Egypt were destroyed in the time of Jeremiah. Jeremiah said, "You must not go down to Egypt," but to them, Egypt was the great secure city. No one had ever overthrown Egypt. It was the one thing that stood. And they went down to Egypt. While they were in Egypt, according to Jeremiah's prophecy, the cities of Egypt were destroyed. And then the Apostle John warns of the fall of the new Babylon, the seemingly impregnable city of Rome. "Woe, woe, woe, great city, where all who had ships on the sea became rich through her wealth. In 1 hour she was brought to ruin." But heaven saw it rather differently from the people on the earth. "Rejoice over her, O heaven, rejoice, saints and apostles and prophets. God has judged her for the way that she treated you." Now, great cities are by their nature rich, and riches bring an arrogant independence of God. You're in the country, you're near to nature, you're near to the nature that God has given. But in the cities, we feel a sort of independence of God. We find a way of life without all that. And yet God allowed 3 centuries to run between John's vision of Babylon and the new Babylon and the fall of Rome. And in those 3 centuries, the church was at work and the gospel spread in Rome and the gospel spread across the empire. So 2 forces in the city were the power and arrogance of worldly wealth and the power of the church of God. And we have to remember today the power of the Church of God. But cities, in a worldly way, symbolize success. And the trouble with success is that some are successful and some are not. And success kills the sense of community. The rich and the middling rich live apart from the poor, and the poor become a kind of forgotten underclass living on the wrong side of the railroad. The first time I traveled by Amtrak down from New York to Washington, we slowed down coming into Baltimore Station, and I have seldom seen such awful slums as they were. And I asked the other day whether those slums were still there. I was told, yes, they were still there. The rich move out to the leafy suburb, and the poor are left behind, unseen and uncared for. When I was a boy, my city centre church had a Sunday school that was mostly working class. The lads I was in the class with were working class lads, and so were many of those who worshipped with us every Sunday. It was a real mix, socially a real mix. But today that church is out among the expensive townhouses around the university in Belfast, and I doubt if many poor people attended on a Sunday. I don't think any do. In Los Angeles, anyone with enough money moved out of the center to Orange County in the south or the San Fernando Valley in the north. Now the valley is thought to be going downhill and they're moving out again. But we went to see a friend who had moved out beyond the valley, and what they were doing was living in a gated compound. I don't see all the new houses were in gated compounds, and I don't see there's much sense of general community in living in a gated compound. and I understand that the gated compounds are spreading. Now, city centre churches are in a bit of a fix. To begin with, the congregation move out, and so long as there are parking lots, they drive in for Sunday services. But the church is no longer a place where you can ask your neighbour to call by on a Sunday, and the Sunday school finds it harder to bring in the local kids. One-class suburbs, in fact, create one-class churches, out of touch with the rich variety of life in the city. And soon they're like any other social club for like-minded people. They talk of the development of their splendid choir and the need to buy extra land to extend the parking lot. And I quote from life, one church where I was given a tour around, and those were the main points that emerged. But that's not the way the church grows, it's the way the church dies. But it doesn't have to be like that. There are, thank God, still churches which are the salt of the earth and the light of the world, and the future is with them. I've spent the last 8 years, a little bit more overlapping with the European Parliament, in visiting evangelical churches in the major cities of Britain. And I've seen how the church grows. And the object of these visits was to try to help churches be more effective in meeting the appalling needs of our sick, secular society. Britain, like the States, is under the intellectual leadership of people who think that their social researchers have found a new way of life, and the new way of life is that everyone should do what is right in their own eyes. And that has led to the breakup, the appalling breakup, the unprecedented breakup of society's basic institution, which is the family. Until now, every religion or culture in the world has made the family its cornerstone. For the Jews, Christians, Islam, Sikhs, Hindus, Shinto, Confucians, and Buddhists, the family is central to the social order. It is where children are taught, with a combination of love and discipline, how to behave before they're let loose on society. The social scientists of today, they say they know better. And the result has been the breakup of marriage on an unprecedented scale. And the social scientists say, not to worry, statistical evidence shows that the children of broken families get along just as well as those with stable families. Well, that is not the evidence of the church. The evidence of the church that has to pick up the bits is absolutely contrary to that. The evidence of the church is that the breakup of the family is total disaster. Our evidence gained on the ground from those whose job it is to deal with people in trouble is that the breakup of the family is central to the problems of those the church now has to help. About 10 years ago, our church in Cambridge, in the city centre, found teenagers sleeping rough. Mum's new man had thrown them out. Either he gets out or I get out. And Mum had gone along with the new man, and they'd gone out. Or the rows were so awful that despite the rough living, life with their mates, who were friends, in the cold was far better than life with Mum's new man. Another result of our leaving the family behind in our materialistic society is that the rich and powerful get richer and the poor and weak get poorer. Our very materialistic society allows no rise in taxes. Watch my lips, no new taxes. And that got him elected. So the community can do nothing more than they're doing to get the poor out of their poverty, to help them keep healthy, and to give them better housing. Zero, nothing more. There is a crude, of course, and inexorable logic in materialism. If there is no life after death, and all we will ever have is what we can lay hands on in this life, then we will grab what we can, while we can, however we can, Enron, and hold on to it as hard as we can. You know that the company is going down, but you grab your bit before it sinks. The shopping malls have become our new temples. But that society is very, very rough on the underdog. It is a society of the haves, and the have-nots don't have any part of it at all. There is no sense of community between rich and poor. Our materialism blights the urban environment. There's no point in talking about, how you should architecture your city or anything like that. At the core of the thing, materialism blights our urban environment. And materialism also corrupts politics. This is a great democratic country which relies on the fact that in the end, the citizen has his say or her say. But the candidates in the last presidential election were selected, in fact, by a tiny group of billionaires, and the party conventions were presented with a done deed. So who for who in the presidential election was not decided, as it should have been, by the parties in convention. It was decided by the millionaires who gave their money to put one ahead of the other. And that is not democracy. And as we've seen from the Enron affair, greed also corrupts business. I happen to be a public accountant, a chartered accountant in our country. I am appalled. I'm appalled at Arthur Andersen. What they were thinking of doing. And the get-outs explaining why they didn't do this and they didn't do that. You are meant as an accountant to think of the people who depend on you to tell them whether this business is being run correctly or not. And the Arthur Andersen people must have known it was not being run correctly. And yet, they did nothing about it, and they took their fees on the side. That is kind of, if you get the safeguards of society wrong, the safeguards in politics of the democratic base, the safeguards in business of people who will guarantee on their professional hand on their heart that this is okay, then we are living in a deeply corrupt society. And business is the lifeblood of the richest country on earth, and at some degree of corruption, when investors can no longer believe the audited figures of major corporations, there is going to be a stock market crash, which will make 1929 look like a mild dip. Corruption is the main reason for poverty of poor nations, and the reason why the trustworthy West is so wealthy. I mean, I've been around the world more than most people have. I've talked more than most people to politicians in private and to business in private, and the reason that the wealth of the West is 10 times and remains 10 times, despite all the aid, that of the developing countries is that the West has managed to get on top of corruption. Not any longer. Faced with this disastrous grip of secular humanism on the intellectual leadership of our day, what can the church do? Now, unlike the religious right, or Francis Schaeffer, with most of which he's written, I agree, I do not think we can change our culture through politics from the top down. That is not how the Christian church won over the Roman Empire, nor how when the empire fell, our pagan ancestors were converted. Politics reflect culture. Politics will be sound if the culture is sound, and they will be corrupt if the culture is corrupt. So changing hearts and minds of those around us is the way to get the politics to follow. I found in my 7 years at the heart of the problems of our sick society that there is no substitute for Christ's second great command, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. Your second great command is not that you shall have a great evangelistic campaign. It is that you shall love your neighbor. We shall love our neighbors as ourselves. How can we preach a God of sacrificial love to people who have never experienced any kind of love from us or from anybody else. They don't know what love is. But when Christians show love to those who are in need, as our Lord did, they see converts, as he did, and as Christians have done throughout the long centuries. To the church in a safe suburb, outreach to the rough end of society seems to be impossible. You talk to those people, they wouldn't know how to start it, they say. Well, they don't say, but you know they wouldn't know how to start it. But with God's help, it can be done. It is being done. And those who do it, this is the odd thing, those who do it do not think that it is at all remarkable. They find that most people respond to practical care for their pressing problems. The example of Christ. Christ preached the word, but he also healed the sick, and he fed the hungry, and though for many the word was too hard and they went away, nevertheless, the people flocked to him, and many believed. Now let me just take, going from the sort of highfalutin general principles to link it to how it's done in the here and now. And I'll give you two examples. There's a church in the Garston Docks, which is a rough district upstream in the Mersey from the centre of Liverpool. It decided it was going to try to reach out. Well, nobody was going to come into the chapel, that was sure. So they opened a coffee shop right opposite the local supermarket. And this was the first big thing. A young businessman gave up his job to manage it. He was on the up and up in business, but he gave up his job to manage it. The women who served there were all Christians, and they were sympathetic listeners, and a lot of people have problems, and if you have a listener, they will pour out their problems. And they got to know the regulars. It was a neutral ground, people who would never have come to church, but all of whom had crying needs. Everyone in our sick society has crying needs today. But the church cared for people's pressing problems. So they came and they talked and they began to understand what the Christian faith was. It wasn't pushed at them, but it was there and it clearly underpinned these people and they talked about it naturally. And a great many became Christians. So the church grew. And as the church grew, Sunday services had to move from the old chapel at the docks to a school about a mile away. And the school building also had space, so they could open up projects for groups in need. They got together a group of youngsters who suffered from Down syndrome. Now, most people don't want to know anything about children who suffer from Down syndrome. They're on their mother's hands, and they look awkward and awful, so we don't actually talk to them. But there was a group of children who suffered from Down syndrome, and they were formed into a choir. And the church started a victim support system to help those traumatized by losses through break-in and theft in that very rough district. They opened a divorce recovery workshop to those whose spouses had left them, and they had a group for single mothers, another group for pregnant teenagers. They had a youth group that started a soccer team. It so happened that the minister had been the coach of Liverpool Football Club's under 16, so that was a great help. And he still kept a soccer ball in his vestry. Then disaster struck. The Liverpool City Council decided to sell the school buildings, to merge two schools and to sell the school buildings for housing development. And the church protested and offered to buy them. It was the only thing that they could do. Desperately, they wanted to keep all this together, and they saw the housing being swept away. But by now, the church was popular in the neighborhood, and the Liverpool City Council realized it was popular, so they had to at least let them make an offer. But of course, what they did was they put a price on it, which they thought would be well outside the reach of the church. And the church swallowed very hard, and yet they found all of the money. It was five times that, not very rich churches, annual income. It was raised by 200 members, and there was enough over afterwards to help change the buildings to have yet new projects. And the money came in because two-thirds of the congregation were new Christians, and they had this strong sympathy for the pressing needs of their friends and neighbours. They had found Christ through this church. Their friends and neighbours needed Christ, and they were not going to give up. If they had to sell everything, they were not going to give up, so they made sure they kept the church. Well, we were at the opening. The mayor of Liverpool came to the opening. And the mayors in this day and age and councillors tend to see things through the eyes of secular society. They're not coming looking for something good out of a church. They come because they feel they have to come, or somebody's told them that they ought to come. The Down Syndrome Choir sang their heart out. It really was quite a remarkable performance. And one of the boys, his face beaming all over and his hair plastered down, gave the mayor the bouquet of flowers. She was so impressed, this hard-bitten-looking mayor, that she cancelled her new engagement to stay and look around, and then she asked the choir to be her guests at the City Hall, where they all had to sit in her mayoral chair and wear her chain. So there, the link between the church and the state was re-established, because the state had been bound to find a real respect for this church. Another church of the same size did a similar project, not again a very big church. Crewe is one of Britain's biggest rail junctions, linking six major cities. The church had a congregation of about 150. There were rats under the boards. One speaker saw a rat going down there and emerging over here. And it was about in the rough end of the town, about half a mile from the focus of the drug dealing. But it also raised enough money from its members, who were not at all rich, and made the same kind of conversion as at Garston for projects to help people in need around them. They bought a butcher shop. The butcher apparently had been not declaring his income for tax purposes, because it all came in cash, and the income tax had found out about it, and he needed a lot of money in a very short time. So the church got a bargain. Anyhow, they bought this butcher shop, and they converted it into a cafe, and they found, as the Garston Church found, that this made the church far more accessible to outsiders. And the church had been at a bus stop, but behind the bus stop was this forbidding church door that was shut all through the week, so that the church was the place where the door was always shut. So they ripped the door off, they opened a bookshop with photocopying and fax services to get people in, and they redid the back halls for all their other projects. It was a mothers and toddlers group, started by grandmothers, carried on by the church's young mothers, a group of single mothers, a youth group of about 70 teenagers with their own football team, and even an art group. And a steady stream of conversions raised the numbers from 150 to 250 by exactly the same kind of process. This time it wasn't the mayor who came, it was the local member of parliament. Gwynneth Dunwoody is as tough as old nails. I mean, people dread her in the House of Commons. Government in particular dreads her. she is the most hard-bitten and critical Labour member of parliament we have. And she was enormously impressed. So anyone who can impress Gwynneth Dunwoody, believe me, has obviously done something. Now, most city centre churches try to meet the needs around them. But what a city really needs is a practical partnership, talking about where we are. That is to say that there are these city centre churches and there are people out in the rich and leafy suburbs. What a city needs is a practical partnership between the poor churches in the problem districts and the churches with the resources of cash and talent. And I spent the last 10 years in trying to put that link together in what we call a Christian Action Network for a city, so that all of the churches are in a network. They're committed to the work of reaching out to the needs of people in the city, and the needs in our cities in this day and age, with the complete dissolution of all social structure. The needs are absolutely appalling, and it's instinctively people come to church doors. They say, well, we thought you were here to help, and we are here to help, but sometimes not much help comes. But when people come knocking on church doors, you need to know where to send them, so you need to know where the projects are in the city. So we have for every city a booklet showing where all the projects are, so that any minister or any elder or anyone in charge in a church can look after the people who come. Not that they can find necessary help there, but he knows or she knows where to send them for help. We did find that it was a help to the poor churches not to be taken under the paternalistic wing of one rich church in the suburb. They don't like that, and you can understand why. They took much more kindly to this idea of a partnership in a Christian Action citywide network backed by the churches and run by a group of people in whom they had some say, to whom they had some input. And the first thing they did was to do a directory showing where the help was available, then where there were the gaps in the help that is available in a city. There are about 30 different kinds of projects that are needed in cities today, and not every city, very few cities have all of those projects. So ideally, the churches should give those running the projects the same time up front as you would give to your missionaries. They are missionaries, and so that members could pray, could donate, and if they thought they could help, volunteer for work in a project like that. So the churches are committed to backing up the projects in the city and to helping particularly the churches in the rough areas who are at the forefront of those projects. And we, in turn, at the Evangelical Alliance, promised to pass on best practice from all the projects we visited, and it's published in a slim book called It Can Be Done, which I think is somewhere out of the back there. And I was greatly inspired, I'm bound to say I was greatly inspired by the people that I met and the practical love for the people they helped. They were not supermen and superwomen. They were not the kind of people who go on TV and say, I wonder what it was. They were mostly quiet people. The main thing was that they were unthreatening people. The people who came in off the streets did not want to meet some, you know, powerful personality. They wanted to meet somebody quiet and unthreatening who would listen, be patient, and hear them out. But they were all competent in their job. They all were full of imagination as to find new ways of helping, and they had a real feeling of care for those whom they were trying to help. So you don't have to be a miracle worker to do that kind of work. You just have to care for people and listen to people and be patient and unthreatening, a little bit laid back. So we visited about 40 cities. Almost all agreed. It was very difficult not to agree, with the idea of a network. But there was always a long gap between, yes, we'll do it, and actually getting it done. We now have 25 Christian Action networks, more or less up and running, and the team I left behind are following up with about 15 more. There's a limit to what we can do, but once you get the thing off the ground and becomes part of the pattern of what is done in the country, then it has its own momentum. Now, what these visits leave is a deep sense of the power of Christian love, the power of Christian love. We have a power that is the greatest power in this fallen world. People tell you that their priority is the preaching of the gospel. Mostly when I went to churches and tried to get them to do this, the preaching of the gospel was their way out. We are here to preach the gospel. So I used to ask them, and how many people come from outside to listen to the gospel? And there was a long silence. It was perfectly clear they were preaching the gospel to the converted, and that not many other people were getting converted. But the fact is that Christ made no separation between caring for people's physical needs and caring for their spiritual needs. He did both. Why should you not do both? If you love people, you love them body and soul. You love all of them. You don't say, I just love their soul. I want their soul. And that's what matters, because that will take them to heaven. You love them. If you love them, you love them body and soul and care for their needs, just as Christ cared for the needs of the people he met. He was going into a city, and he met a widow coming out Her husband had gone, and now her only son had gone. And in those days, a woman needed a man. And she was absolutely bereft. So Christ's heart went out to her. He stopped. Whatever he was doing, he stopped. And he raised her son to life and gave her back her son. It's that heart of love that can't help helping people. That's the kind of heart of Christ, and that is the kind of heart that we should have. And when he told people about the second commandment, to love our neighbor as ourselves, someone who clearly wanted to limit the number of inconvenient neighbors asked, who is my neighbor? Pin it down. Here or there or there? Is it my immediate neighbor? How far do you want me to go? And he told the parable of the Good Samaritan. The Good Samaritan was not a Jew. He stopped to help the wounded Jew. And the two religious people passed by because their divine service was far more important and urgent than people lying in ditches. And after all, the people who should be keeping control of thefts on the Jericho road were the Romans, not the Jews. So they passed by the wounded man. We should not pass by the wounded people lying in ditches in our country. And I found that it is in the churches caring for the needs of their neighbors. They are the churches that are filled with new converts, and that the first converts go back and insist that their friends come too. There is no one more insistent on getting friends out than a new convert who has suddenly been filled with the Spirit, found new life, knows what it is all about, and you want Mary next door to come too. And you go back and you're insistent, you're far more insistent than any of us could ever be that Mary comes too. So the churches get full up and it rolls. So we have now, I think, got back to the way that the church grew when it did grow. We take it for granted that the church grew in the Roman Empire. How did the church grow in the Roman Empire? It didn't grow by sending in petitions to the Senate. It didn't grow by trying to be respectable in Rome. It grew because Christians were good neighbors. They were loving neighbors. They were caring neighbors. They looked after people and their children and so on. And so they got respect from their neighbors around, and their neighbors began to see through the tawdry paganism of the multiplication of gods that they got around, which didn't mean a thing, and that this actually meant something in their lives and in their hearts, and they became Christians. It's an enormous thing that this mighty Roman Empire was taken over by Christians in 300 years. It's an extraordinary phenomenon. But that's how it was done. It's clear that that's what they were told to do. It's clear that that's what they must have done. It's clear that they had respect. It's clear that even the Roman Emperor decided that he too wanted to be a Christian. Then disaster struck. 100 years after Constantine, the empire fell, and all these pagan tribes came sweeping through, all of our ancestors. The Saxons and the Goths, and I don't know where we come from, but we come from all that lot that came rampaging through from the northern forests. And they became Christians as well. How did they become Christians? They became Christians because the church sent out little missions. They sent up little mission stations, and they cared for the sick, they cared for the travelers, they cared for the old, they cared for the children, and they also earned respect. And in about 300 years, the pagans were also converted, and they cut down the sacred trees, and they decided that all of that was a lot of rubbish, and they became Christians. We forget, because of the power of Rome in the Middle Ages, we forget the first millennium was a matter of enormous expansion of the church to people who were pure pagans. And how did the Chinese church get to be 100 million people in the Chinese church, which is the current estimate, right through all the persecution of Mao Zedong? That's how it happened. The missionaries all went. much the tongue started to persecute, and you end up, at the end of that time, with a church that is about 100 million. How could they have become a church of 100 million without Billy Graham, just by being good neighbors? People respected them. People saw that their love was something absolutely different from anything that they had. It was no cold Confucianism. It was a real love, and they became converted. Now, we can do exactly the same kind of thing in our day and age. We need to find in our city people who knows how to rehabilitate drug addicts, someone who knows how to get alongside violent teenagers, someone to give advice to pregnant teenagers, someone who keeps in touch with them when they become single mums, or someone who sees them through the terrible post-abortion trauma, someone who knows how to help the jobless find work, someone has the gift to get the very young, almost unemployable, out of bed and into constructive work, who's looking after the homeless, old and young, and whereas there are refuge for battered wives, and who advises those who have got into the hands of moneylenders. Moneylenders charge about 40%, 50%, 500%. It's a hidden racket. Who keeps prisoners in touch with their families? Who helps ex-prisoners back into a useful and productive life? Who sits with those whose friends have deserted them, who are dying of AIDS? That is the toughest job of all. It's mostly done by middle-aged ladies. And they are actually the only Christians really respected by the gay community. But they do that job, and that's a very rough job. And if churches set up a city network, they have to look after it. It's all too easy to leave to one enthusiastic minister. Then when he moves on, the whole thing collapses. Or as in the case of Belfast, it was the key lady was the one who looked after the social work in the Presbyterian Church, and she went and got married and went to live in Edinburgh. So that was the end of that. We had to start all over again there. So you need to be persistent in trying to set these things up. You need to try to see that they not only agree, but they actually get going, and that they are manned, and that they are sustained. And you need to make sure that these projects can come to talk to your people in your churches, tell you what they're doing, call for volunteers, for help, for cash to expand, and they will know whether the volunteers can do the job or not. They will know much better than you do whether the volunteers can do the job or not. I am setting it up in what we Brits regard ourselves as really rather amateurs at everything, you know. We do these things and we're amateurs and we don't do them terribly well. But when it gets to America, then you have a system. And you get hold of the thing and you really make it run. So what I'd like to see is our really shambolic Christian action networks penetrate America, get taken up by those of you who know how to managing projects. And if you take it up and you get it going, then I think that you will do it really well, much better than we will come and admire you and see how much better you've done it than we've done it. But let me just end. When it gets done, I think you will be surprised at the impact of it. And that is because the power of God is far, far greater than the power of secular humanism. Our societies were built on Christian ethics, and secular humanism has wrecked them, has no power of its own to put things right. If they've gone wrong, it's in a state of denial, but it is the only philosophy in town, and we are not going to change it from the top down. The answer does not lie inside the Beltway. It lies out there in our cities where people are. And our societies can be changed from the bottom up, and they will be changed from the bottom up, and it's already happening. In our country, local government was deeply hostile to Christians having anything to do with social projects. Today they see what the Christians are able to do, and they're pleading for help. Yesterday it was assumed that the only interest of the church was making proselytes. Now we're told, and we were told that Christianity was only one of a number of religions, and now we're told that faith projects really need to come in to help the social services, because the social services can no longer cope with the chaos that has been produced. One of the last cities we visited was Derby, which is the home of Rolls-Royce aero engines. There were about 100 people there from the churches in Derby, and the mayor welcomed us very warmly. And he said that the social services could no longer cope with the mounting problems, and he urged us to do all we could to help. And what was remarkable was that the mayor was a Muslim. And we're told that we are only one faith among many. The fact that the Muslims are only 5% of the population doesn't seem to matter to the secular humanist in charge. The fact that there is more than one faith means really it's just an excuse for sidelining Christianity. But it's clear that if the Christians are active in a city, they cannot be sidelined, and that even the Muslims come to them asking for help. Our countries are democracies where government get their power and authority from the people. And I was a member of the European Parliament Joint Committee with the US Congress. We used to come over here once a year. They used to come to us once a year, and we used to go every time we came over here. We used to go to somebody's district, so we not only saw the congressman, but we saw his own people. And it's very clear to us that congressmen and women are very, very close to their district. That is where they get their power from. That's what they depend on. If they get things wrong, somebody can run in a primary against them, and they have to get re-elected every 2 years. So it's really, they concentrate on looking after their own patch. And therefore, they know what is helpful and what is not helpful to their own people. And they are now being faced, increasingly, our members of parliament and your congressmen, with the reality of the social breakdown that the secular agenda causes. And they will listen to those who are giving their time and energy and money in trying to deal with it. A prime rule of politics is that you listen to those who can deliver, and you do not waste much time on those who can't deliver. So that's why British city governments have softened towards the churches, and why the same should happen here. And if American churches are good neighbors to those in need, congressmen will come to see that the problems are created by the ideologues within the Beltway, and that the people dealing with the problems that they have created are the churches in their district. And government listens in the end only to those who can deliver effective solutions. And in the end, if you do your part, it will stop listening to the clever fools who have created all the problems. Thank you.